not the military industrial media. This is Active Ingredients. I'm Ed Russell. In October 2003, Tariq Ali spoke at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Considering Tariq Ali anticipated much of what has transpired since that time in Iraq, it may be time well spent to listen to that talk again. Obviously, I think so. Tariq Ali is a novelist, historian, political campaigner, and a contributing editor to the New Left Review. Active Ingredients presents this archival edition for your consideration.
When 9/11 happened, a number of us have been analyzing why it happened and how to prevent acts like that happening again, began a debate and a dialogue. Initially, in the early years, in the early weeks, in the early months, with spokesmen from the Bush administration, from the Republican Party in different parts of the world, I had to encounter them. And not a very pleasant experience, but I had to do it. And we asked, what do you really want? If your aim is to stop the flow of recruits into organizations like Al-Qaeda, then you have a very clear option and a very clear way of doing it. If, however, you want to use the events of 9/11 to get your way in other parts of the world, then we can't be of any assistance. And it's the latter option which they took. Because if they had decided that the real problem was the despair and bitterness in the Muslim world and the Arab world, and if they had asked themselves, how are we going to stop the kids from going in the direction they're going, there were two questions which came up immediately. The first, almost a blind spot in this country, though not elsewhere in the world, was the question of Palestine. The second was the campaign of sanctions against Iraq, which had been policed by the United Nations for nearly 12 years, the weekly bombing raids against Iraq, which had begun soon after the Gulf War, sanctioned by the United Nations, which meant that Iraq had been under continuous bombing attack more than any other country in the world since the conclusion of the Second World War. The war in Iraq and the bombing of Iraq went on much longer than the bombing of Vietnam. And we said to the administration and its apologists here and in Europe, there are two ways. One is to wage more war, which will produce more terrorism, more attacks, more violence. The other is to think of a political solution to these problems. And the only political solution to these problems that is available is the following. As far as Iraq is concerned, we urge you to lift the sanctions against Iraq, which have crippled that country, crippled its population, led to the death of 500,000 kids from malnourishment, according to UNESCO figures, and made the people of that country more dependent on the Iraqi regime than ever they were before. In order to survive, in order to get health facilities, in order to get food subsidies, because of the sanctions, they are more dependent on the regime, not less. So you can't have it both ways, saying this is a vicious, evil dictatorship, which no one can do anything about, if you keep these sanctions in place and make the people dependent on the regime. The second thing we advised them was solve the question of Palestine. That the continuing occupation of Palestine by the Israeli state is something which is never going to appeal to the people of that part of that world. It is going to create more bitterness, more despair, more anger. And what is the point of it? And I said in many debates, both with the Israelis and with the US officials, don't give us this argument that we offer the Palestinians everything, they refuse. I said it's bullshit. No one believes it. You offer nothing. You offer them the status of a protectorate, a permanent protectorate. The Oslo Accords, as my dear friend, the late Edward Said, used to say, offered us nothing. All they offered was shriveled little Bantustans, divided from each other by Israeli roads on which Palestinians were not allowed, infiltrated permanently by Israeli settlers, overlooked permanently by Israeli tanks. What sort of independence is that? The South African Bantustans had more independence than that. So it was hardly a surprise that the Second Intifada happened. This was not simply an intifada against Israel and Sharon, which it was. It was also an intifada against the Palestinian leadership, which had accepted the Oslo Accords and done nothing. It was a dual intifada. And they didn't listen. Ariel Sharon became a valued ally in the war against terrorism. Vladimir Putin in Russia became a valued ally in the war against terrorism. He had killed more Chechens than Milosevic killed Kosovans. I mean, the maximum figures, when it finally we got the real reports from Kosovo, which were awful enough, were 2,000 people had died. In Chechnya, several thousand people were killed. The city of Grozny was razed to the dust, but that was fine because Putin was fighting terrorism. The refugee camp of Jenin was attacked, people killed, Ramallah invaded, people died. Every single day, you get emails from the Israeli peace movement, courageous people inside Israel monitoring all this, and human rights monitors in Palestine. Every single day. And there is one consistency in their reports, that every single day young children are being targeted and killed. Now, the Israeli Defense Force is a very disciplined organization. They obey orders. They do what they are told. Why are so many kids dying in Palestine? And they are not being shot in the arm or the leg. In many cases, if not the majority, I don't have the exact figures, bullets in the head to kill. And the world sits and watches. This world where human rights has become a code word for doing whatever needs to be done to occupy countries, where there's talk of humanitarian intervention. But as far as Palestine is concerned, the Western world in particular, and the United States especially, are blind. And there is more criticism of what Sharon is doing to the Palestinians in the Israeli press than in the United States media. Think about that. And often I tell people I encounter from the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the LA Times, or the sort of so-called liberal papers, why don't you just reprint a few reports each week from the Israeli press? Then you don't have to take any risks yourselves. These are Israelis saying it. The reports are written in Hebrew. Just print them in English. Before Sharon went into the occupied territories, an Israeli colonel, serving colonel in the Israeli army, was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Maariv as saying, and I quote, "If the politicians send us in to occupy the Palestinian territories, whether people like it or not, the tactics we will have to use in repressing them will be the same tactics as were used by the Germans in occupying the Warsaw Ghetto." Not said by me, not said by any Palestinian, said by an Israeli colonel, reported in the Israeli press, reported on the internet, reported on dissident websites. New York Times? No. Forget the thought. Washington Post? No. Even the European papers, who are better on this question, didn't report it. Now, in this situation, you have an amazing intervention from a Zionist leader, one of the Zionist leaders of Israel, the former chairman of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, Abraham Burg, who writes rather a moving plea to his own countrymen, saying, stop, what have we come down to? Do you realize what we're doing to the Palestinians? Have you forgotten what we've suffered ourselves? Don't you realize that if you reduce them to this degree of bitterness and anger and leave them nothing, they have no option but to do what they're doing? And do you think this will end well? And he wrote, I am ashamed to be a Zionist, because our philosophy was not to do this to other people, but to get a homeland for ourselves. This article was printed in the Israeli press, and mercifully, that's how we found out, it was printed in every single European, leading European newspaper. I don't think it saw the light of day in the United States. I may be wrong, but all my American friends have said they'd never even heard of it. It had a mega impact in Europe. But he said it because he knew that what was going on was untenable. It couldn't carry on like that. Because if you keep repressing a people, if you reduce people to a level where it's almost easier to die than to live, then people do desperate things. And they do desperate things not because they want to, but because they feel there's no other channel left. And I think the United States administration, after 9/11, lost a very big opportunity in settling that question by getting the Israelis to pull out back to the 67 borders and permitting the Palestinians to have their own democratic, independent, sovereign republic. Big, big mistake for which they are now paying a big price. That one act alone would have reduced the attraction of groups like Al-Qaeda to a whole number of young people, middle-class kids, professionals, growing up in that world. But Washington decided not to go down that route. Instead, it backed Ariel Sharon. And what did it do in Iraq? One day after 9/11, Bob Woodward tells us, there was a meeting of the National Security Council in the White House, and there was a big debate between these intellectual giants who sit around the table. George Bush, Dick Cheney, Ashcroft, who found time to come away from writing hymns to attend this crucial meeting, Condi Rice, and others. And the big decision they had to take was, should we go for Afghanistan or Iraq? What on earth had Iraq to do with 9/11? Absolutely nothing. The Al-Qaeda leadership hated the Iraqi regime because it was a totally secular regime. There were big clashes between their supporters and the Ba'athists, both in Syria and in Iraq. So what had it to do with that? And if Bob Woodward is to be believed, and he talked to all the top bots, the official sources, Condi Rice was quoted as saying, let us use 9/11 to get our own way everywhere in the world. And they decided to go for Afghanistan, which incidentally is not talked about very much. You don't read about it, you don't hear about it too much, it's not on your television screens, but it's a total and complete mess. Complete mess. That the puppet leader put into power in Kabul, Hamid Karzai, the man with the lovely shawls, who really should be modeling them in Paris or New York rather than running Afghanistan, that this dear sweet old boy who once worked for the CIA and has now been put in charge of Kabul is so confident of his popularity that he doesn't allow a single Afghan be a member of his bodyguard. He has to be guarded by US Marines. And he can't do anything. Afghanistan is run by the Northern Alliance. Do you remember that those wonderful occasions soon after 9/11 when Laura Bush and Cherie Blair, Tony Blair's wife, had that television tete-a-tete and the discussions on radio where they said the reason we have to invade Afghanistan is to improve the condition of Afghani women? this would have been the first imperial intervention in favor of women's liberation. Not something they're very well known for. But that's what we were told. Well, go and look at Afghanistan today. The women are complaining. Nothing much has changed. They had this usual thing they do immediately after they occupy a country of some media image, and they found a poor Afghan woman who used to be a newscaster in the old days and found her reading the news on a television service which didn't exist, i.e. Afghan television. This was flashed round the network saying Afghan women are in the forefront again. But you go and talk to the real women of Afghanistan and they will tell you how miserable their lives and their conditions are today. That has not changed. And Hamid Karzai admits that he is powerless. His brother runs an Afghan restaurant in Baltimore. Well, at least he's doing something useful. He's feeding a few people. But not Hamid. He's been put there, and I always say to his friends in the British Foreign Office and in the United States, if you really like the guy, pull him out, because you've only shortened his lifespan by sending him there. He won't last long. He should be pulled out and found something else to do. It's a complete mess. And this Taliban, which was built up into the most evil force in the world, they are now negotiating with it behind the scenes because they don't trust the Northern Alliance. So don't be too surprised if over the next 6 months or a year you have a new coalition government in Kabul, which includes a large chunk of the former Taliban. Don't be too surprised, because discussions are already taking place. These are the lies that are told, the lies that are told when they go to war. So that's Afghanistan, already a mess. Then we have Iraq. Why take Iraq? What was the point in taking Iraq? Was it the oil? I don't think so. I mean, they need the oil. Of course we know that. That's why you have billions of dollars of security arrangements for that whole region. But if it was just the oil, they could have done a deal with the regime as they'd done before in the 80s. When the regime was at its most repressive was when it was a close ally of the West. It wasn't just the oil. I think it was a display of imperial power. And it was a display of imperial power, not just for the Arab world and not just to appease the Israelis who wanted this regime removed at all costs because it was backing the Palestinians and they saw in it a potential threat at some stage in the future. It was a display of imperial power for all their potential rivals in the Far East and in Europe, saying we're doing this, we can do it. It's like, remember when they dropped the nuclear bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, targeting civilians, chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction. Why did they do that? Because the Japanese were going to defeat them? They were on the edge of defeat. They'd virtually lost the war. It was a matter of weeks. It was a shot across the bows of the communist enemy, which was an ally, but was going to become an enemy during the Cold War years, to show the Russians we've got them and you haven't. And similarly, the occupation of Iraq was to show all their rivals all over the globe, we can do it and you can't. We have the military might to do it, but you can't do it, this would say to Europe. And they would warn the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese, this is us. Don't tangle with us. That was the reason for the invasion of Iraq. And they thought, they genuinely thought, this is where it was a massive miscalculation. And I wrote about it before the war began. I warned them, if you take Iraq, do not imagine this will be like Pristina. This is Baghdad. This is an independent Arab country. A young Arab country formed in the 20s. It has a long history of resisting the British Empire, which ruled it for 3 decades. And every single year there was a rebellion against the British Empire in some part of Iraq or the other. I said, don't think you will get away with it. Oh, yeah. A large chunk of the population hates Saddam Hussein, but they will hate you even more because there is a strong national consciousness in that country. And they didn't believe us. Who did they believe? They believed the Quislings and the collaborators, some of whom were on their payroll, others who wanted to be in their payroll, others who'd been provided sinecures at American universities. They went to the White House, Kanan Makia and Fuad Ajmi and their hangers-on, and said, go in, you will be welcomed with sweets and flowers. That was reported in the New York Times after this delegation of Iraqis met Bush at the White House. Well, there were no sweets, no flowers, not even in the areas most hostile to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. None of that. Instead, everywhere they went, they were met with hostility. And from the first week, this began to shake the morale of the American soldiers, who had been given two sets of instructions. One, that they were invading a barbaric country led by evil ragheads. That was one side, just pure racism. The second side was the people are waiting to be liberated. These two never coincided, these views, but they were both used. We're going as liberators. The second was the one soldiers preferred to believe, naturally, since most of the soldiers were non-whites anyway and not very amenable to racism. They preferred to believe they were going to liberate a country which was dying and crying to be liberated. And when they arrived, they found a hostile population. You read yesterday's New York Times, the soldier back on furlough, who says, what shook us was the anger, the hostility, the way people looked at us. We had no business being in that country. And these soldiers are realizing it the hard way, unfortunately. But what surprises me is the large numbers of people in the United States and even in Britain who are surprised when you point out to them that the Iraqi people don't like being occupied by the United States. They just don't like it. It's not something they've dreamt about when they've had sort of utopian dreams. Oh, if only the United States would come and occupy us, all would be well. McDonald's and Starbucks. It's not the thing they dream about. And no one understood this till they went in, and now they're in a mess. That's the reason American politics is being turned around. If there was no Iraqi resistance, if they had gone in and there'd been silence, even a sullen silence, it would have been greeted as a massive triumph and a victory. All those who were marginally critical would have been silenced. Instead, the resistance in Iraq has given courage to a few democratic politicians to speak up against the war. It's now become an issue. Were you for or against the war amongst the democratic candidates? And they're all jostling around because most of them supported it. And they're saying, no, we always had our doubts. Well, if you had these doubts, why didn't we hear of them at the time? How come the votes were so large in Congress and the Senate to push it through? Where were your doubts then? It requires a resistance in Iraq to raise doubts, just like it required a massive resistance and an epic struggle in Vietnam to really lift the peace movement to new heights in this country. It's a dialectical relationship. Resistance abroad, opposition at home. And that's what's happening with Iraq now, that there is a resistance. And they're trying to stop it. They're looking for covers. They've got the Security Council to give them the mask of the United Nations or the fig leaf, which they can hold up, saying, look, the UN is backing it. But you're doing this in a part of the world where the UN is hated. Hated because of what it did during the sanctions years, when two leading UN people, one Deputy Secretary General Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, resigned in disgust with their own organization. So having blue-helmeted mercenaries there isn't going to be any better than having Poles or Ukrainians or Bulgarians, all these old Eastern European countries who were referred to once as satellite countries because they did whatever the Soviet Union wanted, and who remain satellite countries, though no one uses that phrase because now they do just what the United States wants. Old habits die hard, especially when the personnel carrying out the orders are virtually the same. They've just changed their coats. From being running the state, they've now become, in many cases, heads of large multinational companies and privatizers. And that's fine, because that's all that matters. That's all that matters. And if you think that neoliberal economics, because that's the epoch in which this new colonialism is taking place, can deliver the goods in Afghanistan and Iraq when it can't deliver them at home, you've got another thing coming. How can people who are privatizing everything at home, attacking public provision in education and health in their own countries, create a health service or an education facility in Afghanistan and Iraq? They don't even believe in it. They did it after the Second World War because they had a very big rival, the Soviet Union. Revolutions erupting all over the world, China, Vietnam, Indonesia, later Cuba. And they needed to make reforms available to make the system more attractive. Now there's no enemy. All that counts is money in profits. And money in profits in the present epoch of the Washington Consensus do not give the people of Iraq or Afghanistan what they want and what they desire. And this restructuring which they talk about is a restructuring which will be carried out largely by U.S. companies. The French and the Germans want some of their companies to be involved. That's the big difference. Why should you have it all? But it's a war of the North against the South. That's how it's seen now in that part of the world, with different factions in the North wanting a bigger share or a smaller share of the loot. That's what's going on, and it will not work. And in my book, Bush in Babylon, I explain why the British occupation of Iraq didn't work for 3 decades. They had 3 decades. They couldn't make it work. And one of the reasons they couldn't make it work, a British intelligence team went in to do a study on Iraq, I think in the 40s, and they said, what we have created in this country is an oligarchy of racketeers. And when this report was sent to the British Foreign Office, the Foreign Office's reply was slightly exaggerated. But it was absolutely accurate. And if that was what they could do in the 40s and 50s, when there was a bigger interest in creating a different sort of a world, in today's epoch, you will have something worse than an oligarchy of racketeers. You will have an oligarchy of foreign racketeers, which is worse because the British created racketeers and landlords to create a social base for themselves in that country. The United States is taking everyone from outside, because they don't trust the Iraqis at all. Even the people cleaning up the U.S. barracks are South Asian or Filipino immigrants. How can you ever expect the people in this country to trust you? And then Paul Wolfowitz. Exactly. One of the most amazing sights is to see Paul Wolfowitz standing in Baghdad, addressing a press conference, mainly composed of Western journalists, and when they say, well, it's not going well, you know, what's the problem in Iraq? He says, the problem in Iraq is there are too many foreigners coming in. Think about it for a minute. What he's referring to is Arabs from the other parts of the Arab world, not the occupying forces. Because these people are so unself-conscious, it's becoming difficult to satirize them. I mean, here you have one-third of the British army, tens of thousands of American soldiers coming from thousands of miles away to occupy an Arab country, and this idiot stands up and says, the problem is there are too many foreigners. I mean, you have to lose, you know, you can't have a sense of reality when you begin to talk like that. So this dual occupation of the Arab world, in my opinion, is not going to end well. And I'll tell you what you're not told in the mainstream media, by and large, in this country, that a large chunk of the Iraqi population is pretty much hostile to the occupation. They don't want it. If a free election by some miracle took place and a parliament was elected, I'm prepared to bet you that the first two demands of this parliament would be, one, all occupying troops out of our country, and B, Iraqi control of Iraqi oil. And then what would they do? Another regime change. That's what they would be forced to do, like they did in Iran in 53 when they toppled the democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh because he nationalized Anglo-Iranian oil. And you know, they do not like oil-producing countries to be governed by democratic governments because there's always a risk.
This is an archival edition of Active Ingredients. You are listening to an October 2003 talk by Tariq Ali. He spoke at Mount Holyoke College in Hadley, Massachusetts. This event was a fundraiser for Western Massachusetts Jobs with Justice.
Look at the attempts being made just to move away, to broaden it a bit, to remove Chavez from power in Venezuela. This guy has been elected 6 times in different ways by the population. The Venezuelan constitution, even its enemies say, is the most democratic constitution in Latin America, which Chavez pushed through against the will of the oligarchy, backed by 2/3 of the population in a referendum. So there's not even the excuse they have with the Iraqi regime. It's not democratic. Here you have a democratic regime. Why do you try and overthrow it? Why do you back the oligarchy? Why do you get the generals on your payroll in that army to try and topple this guy 1 year before you go in to take Iraq? That's what they did. And Chavez was deposed, arrested, locked up for 48 hours, and then there was a mass rebellion. All the poor people in Caracas from the slums came out onto the streets. 500,000 people, slum dwellers, marched onto the Miraflores Palace saying, "Where is our president?" And then an amazing thing happened. The general who carried out the coup triggered off a mutiny in the army. He came out of the Miraflores Palace one day after the coup, and there's this fraudster, the president of the Chamber of Commerce, a well-known local crook, was being sworn in as president, the equivalent of Ahmed Chalabi in Baghdad. He was being sworn in as president, and he came out and told the band, which is permanently outside the palace, which plays the national anthem, welcomes foreign visitors, and he came out and said to them, this general, "The minute the new president comes out, the television cameras will be here. Play the national anthem." And these ordinary soldiers said, "General, what new president? We elected one called Hugo Chavez." He said, "Never mind. That's a decision we've taken." They said, "No, we want to know." And then he turned on the bugler, who plays the bugle every time the president comes out, a 17-year-old kid soldier, and said, "You," he said, "the minute the new president comes out, play the trumpet to honor the president." And this 17-year-old kid said to the general, "We elected President Chavez. He is our president." And the general said, "You will do what I'm saying. I'm a general." And the soldier said, "General, you seem to be very keen to play the trumpet for the new president. Here, play it yourself." Now, what gives a young soldier that confidence to say this to a serving general? What gives him the confidence is that he feels empowered by his government, which is trying to do not anything too dramatically radical, but just use the oil money to improve the conditions of the poor, to give them more schools, more health, more education, more shelter. That's all. A traditional old Rooseveltian New Deal program. That's all. And the United States try and topple them because the example might spread. And it's, you know, didn't need to try and stop them. If you read your New York Times, you know what's going on in Bolivia. It's a massive insurrection against another rogue president. And the United States is backing him. 70 people have been shot dead. The poorest of the poor in Bolivia are being shot dead, and the State Department is backing them. So when you have the empire behaving in this way, when they claim that what they are going to do is in the interests of democracy and freedom, I tend to doubt it. Forgive me. Because the record tells us something completely different. That all they go and do is something in their own interests. Always. All empires have done that. Not just the United States. The British did that. They took most of Africa and said that they were doing it to go and wipe out slavery when the entire wealth of that country of Britain had been built through slavery. That's why they were taking Africa. The Romans used to have similar arguments. I remember reading a biography of Agricola by the Roman historian Tacitus, who wrote a biography of his father-in-law, who was the big proconsul who ruled Britain during the Roman Empire. And he records a very interesting episode in that. He says once Agricola was on the edge of Britain and he looked in the direction of Ireland and said, "What is that?" And his advisors said, "You don't even need to look in that direction. This is a useless place. It's peopled by primitive tribesmen. They are boglands. It's so remote from civilization. We don't want to have anything to do with it." And Agricola came and said to them, "But yes, that's not the point. The point is it occupied by Roman legions or is it not?" And they said, "It is not." He said, "That is where the danger lies. Because people here will begin to say, that island is not occupied by the Roman legions. Perhaps one day we too?" That also helps to explain the occupation of Iraq and the continuing attacks on Syria, the two Arab countries which still refuse to toe the U.S. line on becoming essentially subordinate states in that region and accepting Israeli hegemony. That is also what is going on. The last argument which they make, not the politicians so much, but the tame intellectuals, the pundits and the press when they attack the Arab world, is they say, we are very different from the Arab world. There are civilizational differences, religious differences. Basically, they say, and I've read it in the Western press, it's quite common, these people are incapable of being critical of themselves. They blame everything on the United States. How many times have you heard that? It's not true. In fact, if you travel around the Arab world, you can go into any tea house, any cafe in any Arab capital, and you will see some of the most vicious, savage criticisms against the Arab regimes which rule in that part of the world. It's a much more politically conscious population than the population of the United States of America. That may be a civilizational difference. Everyone is engaged. They want to know how to change these wretched people who rule them, who they don't like. And the hostility to the United States comes because in many cases, not all, but in many cases, these regimes are only there because they have U.S. backing and support. And some of the people in the Arab world, its intellectuals and its poets who've spoken up, have been incredibly self-critical of themselves and their regimes. And I want to just read this out to you because it's not known enough. After the Six-Day War in 1967, when the Israelis launched a preemptive strike against Egypt and Syria, defeated these countries, and since then have been the most favored nation in the region of the United States, a very great Arab poet who essentially wrote love poetry and erotic poetry, Nizar Kabani, sat down and wrote a poem. And when I went to the Arab world after that defeat, In October, November 67, every Arab capital you went, whether you met a civil servant, whether you met a student, whether you met people in the cafe, whether you spoke to taxi drivers, one question they would ask, have you heard Nizar Kabani's latest poem? What was this poem? Let me read it to you to give you a flavor of the degree of self-criticism there is in that word. This is a poem which is called, in English, Footnotes to the Book of Setback. Much of it could apply today to the situation in post-Arab world, post-Iraq. Friends, the old word is dead, the old books are dead. Our speech with holes like worn-out shoes is dead. Dead is the mind that led to defeat. Our poetry has gone sour, women's hair, nights, curtains and sofas have gone sour. Everything has gone sour. My grieved country. In a flash, you changed me from a poet who wrote love poems to a poet who writes with a knife. What we feel is beyond words. We should be ashamed of our poems. Stirred by oriental bombast, by boastful swaggering that never killed a fly, by the fiddle and the drum, we went to war and lost. Our shouting is louder than our actions. Our swords are taller than us. That is our tragedy. In short, we wear the cape of civilization, but our souls live in the Stone Age. You don't win a war with a reed and a flute. Our impatience cost us 50,000 new tents. Don't curse heaven if it abandons you. Don't curse circumstances. God gives victory to whom he wishes. God is not a blacksmith to beat swords. It's painful to listen to the news in the morning. It's painful to listen to the barking of dogs. Our enemies did not cross our borders. They crept through our weaknesses like ants. 5,000 years growing beards in our caves. Our currency is unknown. Our eyes are a haven for flies. Friends, smash the doors, wash your brains, wash your clothes. Friends, read a book, write a book, grow words, pomegranates and grapes. Sail to the country of fog and snow. Nobody knows you exist in caves. We are a thick-skinned people with empty souls. We spend our days practicing witchcraft, playing chess and sleeping. Are we the nation by which God blessed mankind? Our desert oil could have become daggers of flame and fire. We're a disgrace to our noble ancestors. We let our oil flow through the toes of whores. A reference here to the Saudi royal family. We run wildly through the streets, dragging people with ropes, smashing windows and locks. We praise like frogs, swear like frogs, turn midgets into heroes and heroes into scum. We never stop and think. In mosques, we crouch idly, write poems, proverbs, beg God for victory over our enemy. If I knew I'd come to no harm and could see the Sultan, this is what I would say. Sultan, your wild dogs have torn my clothes. Your spies hound me, their eyes hound me, their noses hound me, their feet hound me. They hound me like fate, interrogate my wife and take down the name of my friends. Sultan, when I came close to your walls and talked about my pains, your soldiers beat me with their boots, forced me to eat my shoes. Sultan, you lost two wars. Sultan, half of our people are without tongues. What's the use of a people without tongues? Half of our people are trapped like ants and rats between walls. If I knew I'd come to no harm, I'd tell him, you lost two wars, you lost touch with our children. If we hadn't buried our unity, if we hadn't ripped its young body with bayonets, if it had stayed in our eyes, the dogs wouldn't have savaged our flesh. We want an angry generation to plow the sky, to blow up history, to blow up our thoughts. We want a new generation that does not forgive mistakes, that does not bend. We want a generation of giants. Arab children, corn ears of the future, You will break our chains, kill the opium in our heads, kill the illusions. Arab children, don't read about our suffocated leaders. They are a hopeless case, as worthless as watermelon rind. Don't read about us. Don't ape us. Don't accept us. Don't accept our ideas. We're a nation of crooks and jugglers. Arab children, spring rain, corn ears of the future, you are the generation that will overcome defeat. Now, whatever else you may say about the poem, you can't say it's lacking self-criticism. And this is very common, incidentally, in that world. It's not the case that people blame the United States for no rhyme or reason. They blame them because in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf states in particular, and for a long time in Iraq, they sustained these regimes. They do to this day. That is the reason that the United States is not seen as a power in that world which encourages democracy. If anything, the opposite. And the Iraqi poets who had been exiled by Saddam Hussein, great Arab poets, one of the greatest living poets today, Saadi Yusuf, exiled by Saddam Hussein, totally opposed to the occupation. When I met him the day after Baghdad fell, he was crying. And he said to me, there were three great poets of Iraq, me, Al-Jawahiri, and Muzaffar al-Nawab. Al-Jawahiri is now dead, died at the age of 100. And Saddam used to send us messenger after messenger saying, I know you're radicals, I know you hate me, but you're part of the heritage of Iraq. Come and recite at a poetry reading in Baghdad and there will be a million people. He was right. There would have been a million people to listen to these three great poets. And Saadi Yusuf said, we never went. I said, why? He said, too many of our comrades had been killed when the CIA gave him the lists of communists to kill and wipe out. He did it for them. That hurt. He said, and Muzaffar al-Nawab, my comrade in exile, said, he might kill us, this son of a bitch. We don't trust him. So he said, we told his ambassador, we don't want to come. And he said, the ambassador said, Saddam says the blood on his neck guarantees your safety. And Saadi Yusuf said to me, somehow this was not very reassuring. Now, 1 month before they invaded Iraq, there was a gathering in London in a secret hotel of all these people who've now been put into power. In London, the CIA, British intelligence all backed them. And Saadi Yusuf saw this from his London exile and said, it's a jackal's wedding. And I said, Saadi, what's the importance of a jackal's wedding? He said, in southern Iraq, in the summer months when we sleep under the stars in the night to keep cool, once every 6 months or 3 months, a village will report there was a conclave of jackals. They come, they make a noise, they mate, they cue to mate, and there's a stench which is unbearable. And the next day the villagers get up and they say, oh God, did you notice that? Did you smell that jackal's wedding? And it's forgotten then because you don't hear of them for some time. And he sat down when this conference took place in London of the collaborators who are now running Iraq, the so-called Iraqi National Council, and he wrote a wonderful poem, it's a short poem, called The Jackal's Wedding, for which he is not permitted to go back into Iraq, because this poem went by internet, was circulated everywhere, and all these collaborators were talked about by ordinary people as the Jackal's Wedding. The Jackal's Wedding is coming to town. And it's moving poem. But his friend Muzaffar al-Nawab, another great Iraqi poet, I tell you this to show you how important culture is to the politics of that world and how the two are interrelated, something people have no understanding of in the West. And Muzaffar al-Nawab had been locked up by Saddam, had sought refuge in Iran, had been locked up by the Shah, tortured by the Shah's police, sent back to Iran, and had been in exile since the late 70s, early 80s. And Muzaffar al-Nawab wrote this poem. And he was a poet then and now worshipped by young Iraqis, because the tape circulates all over Iraq. And he said, "I have accepted my fate is like that of a bird, and I have endured all except humiliation or having my heart caged in the Sultan's palace. But dear God, even birds have homes to return to. I fly across this homeland from sea to sea and to prison after prison after prison, each jailer embracing the other." And it was to this friend that the other poet in exile, Sadi Yusuf, sent this poem, The Jackal's Wedding. "O Muzaffar al-Nawab, my lifelong comrade, what are we to do about the jackal's wedding? You remember the old days? In the cool of the evening, under a bamboo roof, propped on soft cushions, stuffed with fine wool, we'd sip tea, a tea I'd never since tasted among friends. Night falls as softly as our words, under the darkening crowns of the date palms, while smoke curls from the hearth, such fragrance as if the universe had just begun. Then a cackling explodes from the long grass and date palms, the jackal's wedding. O Muzaffar al-Nawab, today isn't yesterday. Truth is as evanescent as the dream of a child. Truth is, this time we're at their wedding reception. Yes, the jackal's wedding. You've read the invitation. O Muzaffar al-Nawab, let's make a deal. I'll go in your place. Damascus is too far away from that secret hotel in London. I'll spit in the jackals' faces. I'll spit on their lists. I'll declare that we are the people of Iraq. We are the ancestral trees of this land, proud beneath our modest roof of bamboo." Now that is the spirit of the Iraqi people who are resisting, who have suffered under Saddam, but will refuse to accept the occupation. So how then to resist this empire, which is all-powerful and the only empire? The Security Council is now caved in as well. Not a big surprise. The resistance in the lands that are occupied will carry on as long as the occupation continues. They'll have their highs, their ups, their lows, their downs, but it will carry on. Because an occupied Iraq and an occupied Palestine will never be at peace. People just have to understand that. And that's why we need a strong dissenting opposition in the heart of the empire. That's why all of you are extremely important as citizens of this empire. You're responsible in one way, not directly, but collectively, for having this regime in power. If the whole world could vote for the US president, which is probably what should happen, certainly Bush would never have got elected. Given that they rule large chunks of the world, maybe that's what we should demand. No US corporations without representation. There's no good getting totally paranoid about this regime. It can be toppled. It's not something which is all-powerful, but it can only be toppled if there's an opposition. And there's a big difference at the moment between Iraq and the United States of America. Do you know what it is? In Iraq, they have an opposition. That's the difference. Here, you have the Democrats who wriggle, who wiggle, who say one thing one day, one thing the other. One day Howard Dean says we should be even-handed in Palestine. Is that such a radical thing to say? We should be even-handed in Palestine between the occupier and the oppressed. For me, you can't be even-handed. There's no comparison between state power and what those people are suffering. But never mind, he's trying to be decent. But he then retreats from that as well. He's upset one day because Syria is bombed. The next day he says, well, if there were, of course, these camps there, then they were right to bomb. If this is the extent of leadership to Bush, he'll win. You need a tough voice to take him on, to challenge the lies on every level. And I don't believe it can't be done. It needs politicians with guts. And it needs a movement. Now look, in this country, lots of people think the American empire and American imperialism came into being after the Russians and communism and the Russian Revolution. Not true. This empire has existed for a long time. It's not a traditional sort of an empire. It doesn't like colonial occupations. It prefers to rule through reliable relays, whether they are oligarchies or military dictatorships or politicians. That's how it prefers to rule. Iraq is exceptional for them like that. Like the Philippines was exceptional in the last years of the 19th century. And that occupation of the Philippines brought out the best in American liberalism when Mark Twain and Henry James and William James and a whole host of intellectuals put out a call to form an anti-imperialist league to stop these occupations from taking place. And within 2 years, it had 250,000 members in 25 big American cities. And that is what we are lacking. We have an anti-war movement which goes up and down, but we need a consistency, a consistent intellectual offensive against the lies. And don't tell me the media is too powerful. We know what the media is. We can't depend on that. You know, if you depended on the media, you couldn't understand why Michael Moore's movies are watched by hundreds of thousands of people when they go into the cinemas. Or why Noam Chomsky's little book on 9/11 becomes a bestseller. The media didn't promote that. There is opposition in this country. There is anger, but it has to be mobilized. You have to move forward. And if you completely fall into the trap of saying anyone but Bush, we'll get more problems. I mean, I want Bush to be removed for God's sake. But if you just do it apolitically, that this regime is so horrible, it's no different from other regimes which have existed before. People have short memories. I mean, remember, we know we are angry about the Patriot Act. Disgusting, I agree with you. But have you forgotten Attorney General Palmer's raids? In the middle of the early years of the 20th century, when large numbers of migrants, Germans and Italians, were locked up and deported. It's not new. It's part and parcels of the self-defense mechanisms of this empire. They've done it before. You've forgotten the Quantilpro program, implemented during the Democratic administration during the Vietnam War to spy on people in the anti-war movement. It has happened before. So let's not exaggerate the threat. This is, you know, it's particularly obnoxious because the president himself is not very bright. But the notion that somehow this is qualitatively different from what we've had before is something I don't accept. Look at your own history. Look at what's happened before. Look at the opposition that's been mounted up against it. That's what you have to look at. And it's extremely important. One good thing that has happened as a result of this absurd, irrational war of occupation in Iraq is there is a whole new generation of people, especially young people, who have become more engaged in politics than their predecessor generations. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the most heartening things, both in North America and in Europe, from that point of view, there's no big difference, was the day the bombing of Baghdad began. Hundreds of thousands of school students, young men and young women, the ages of 15 upwards, poured out of the schools onto the streets, chanting slogans which they'd made up, which were the slogans of their own generation, taken from rock songs and punk songs of the period, like the big chant in London of the school students was, "Who let the bombs out? Bush, Bush and Blair," which completely, completely threw us, completely threw us. And it's this spirit that it's somehow become cool again to be politically engaged, which is important. And what Nizar Kabbani was saying about the Arab generations to come, corneas of the future, applies just as much to generations, new generations springing up here and in Western Europe. Because in this war of the North against the South, of the great empire, against its rivals, future rivals, potential rivals and people it characterizes as its current enemies, we need a big opposition in the United States. And on that difficult note, I'll end.
This is Active Ingredients. You have been listening to an archival edition of an Active Ingredients recording from October 2003. The talk was by Tariq Ali. He spoke at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts.